Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host today, Marvin Smith. My partner, Mr. Alan Cardoza, will not be with us today. As some of you may or may not know, Alan is in the process of making a film. So that work keeps him going back and forth to the studio, so I'm running solo today. But as they say, the show must go on. Each week, this show will bring you guests that will inspire, educate, and in some cases, you know, just outright entertain you, while bringing you answers and options to raising children today in a constantly changing future. We will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more as issues evolve around education in the 21st century. With each of us having over 30 years of experience working with families in crisis, we've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the most top professionals in many of the helping fields, and authors sharing valuable stories, helpful information, as we bring you Answers for the Family. Once again, I'm your host today, Marvin Smith. Our guest today, I'm excited. I'm always excited when you have a chance to bring individuals on that can bring us insight into what's going on in our world today that helps us address, educate, and look at things that we may be able to help our family. Our guest today is Jennifer Golick. She's a licensed marriage family therapist. She is the clinical director for Muir Wood Teen Treatment Center. Jennifer has over 16 years of clinical experience in a variety of outpatient and residential treatment facilities. Her work spans from treating severe mental illness to addictions. She is also a seasoned public speaker and has been a featured keynote speaker on addiction dependency, adolescence addiction treatment, cannabis. That old, you know, let me give the other word for cannabis, marijuana, weed. You know, there's a bunch of names for it, but I guess in its technical term, it's called cannabis. So that's our topic today, will be cannabis dependency, adolescence addiction treatment. And our speaker will be Jennifer Golick. Hold on 1 second.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Well, good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm great. Other than, you know, fighting traffic in this crazy Southern California weather, I am, you know, couldn't be better.
Well, it certainly is keeping it interesting for you.
And life should always be interesting, right?
That's right.
So, now, the subject, cannabis.
Yes, cannabis, or
yes.
Weed, or reefer, or whatever you want to call it.
Smoke.
It certainly is the big topic these days.
Yes, and looking at that, and I guess this is an area of your expertise and treatment, what I'd like to do is, you know, looking at your background, just maybe ask some questions, and that you can answer these questions and help our listeners become more insightful to what's happening today. How
certainly.
Does that sound? Okay, so my question number one, why is marijuana considered dangerous now as opposed to the, you know, historic view that it's harmless?
That's a great question, you know, because it's interesting. The common idea about marijuana is that it is a gateway drug, right? That's
yes.
what we all believe to be true, that it's the thing that got you hooked on harder things. And
well,
I think that
hey, Jennifer,
that
and I don't mind if you diving in, me be diving in here with you, but as you're saying that, that's what we've been told. It's the
mm-hmm.
gateway. And I don't, you know, a lot of things we're told doesn't mean that's necessarily true. So you can help dispel those myths as well as we move forward.
Yeah, well, I think it actually was true, you know, 15 or 20 years ago. But what we're seeing now is that the concentration of tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, which is the psychoactive substance in marijuana, is now, you know, at about 25% concentration, whereas 15 years ago it was, you know, 8 to 10%. So you're looking at really high-potency marijuana that is, you know, what the research is showing now, having a significant impact on the developing brain. And so that's why we really have to look at marijuana as being just as addictive and detrimental as street drugs. I think we shouldn't be classifying it as being less harmful or as something that, you know, should be minimized. And this is particularly true for adolescent use, because of the dangers that it poses to, the, again, the adolescent brain development.
The adolescent brain, right, right. Well, and here on the other hand, if we look at from the standpoint of legislation, we're looking at states that are legalizing marijuana. You know, then we have this kind of movement, medical marijuana. I mean, when we start to look at these laws and these implications as far as society, on one hand, we're basically almost saying it is okay. It's not
really the beneficial parts of the marijuana plant, which is the CBD chemical. It's a non-psychoactive part of the drug. That's the pain relieving, the nausea relieving part of the drug. And so that, you know, in terms of using it medicinally, when people say that, you know, they need to get high to get relief, it's really, I think it's not a valid argument. And again, this is a really polarizing topic, and there's really strong views on either side. But I think when we really focus it down to should, you know, 11, 12, 13, 16-year-old kids be smoking this super high-potency marijuana, I think everyone can collectively agree that that's a bad idea.
Right. Well, I think of, too, in the days when I was growing up, which was many moons ago, you know, you used to talk about marijuana and the potency and how over years it has become such much more potent, as you were saying, than it was in the past. Now, why is it more potent today than it was yesterday? I mean, what are the factors? What's making it, if it's that potent, that much more addictive?
Well, it's become a genetically engineered crop, essentially, where you have, you know, really brilliant botanists who are breeding strains of marijuana that have high-potency THC, so they're able to ratchet the levels up with each subsequent breeding cycle.
Okay.
And so there's a lot of science in it. And,
wow.
And so you have people who are able to, you know, sort of genetically alter a plant so that it has this really high psychoactive substance in it.
Otherwise, GMO, right? Genetically.
Something like that.
Yes. Interesting.
Yeah. And so, you know, again, like I said, over time, and there's big business in it, too. So there's a lot of motivation for people to have this substance that creates a greater experience of being high, because then, you know, again, if you have this great experience of being high, you're going to want to go back to the person that sold it to you. So there's a somewhat of an economic supply and demand piece in there as well.
Right.
But what I'm seeing in my treatment work is, you know, unfortunately, we're seeing some really bad cases of kids who are becoming psychotic.
Oh, really?
As a result of smoking high-potency marijuana. Particularly, what I'm seeing a real trend in is the use of BHO or butane hash oil, which is like wax, or call it DAB.
DAB, okay, yes, yes.
And it's that way of ingestion of marijuana has about 80 to 90% THC concentration.
Oh my God.
It's pretty strong
pretty
stuff.
Strong,
and so
yes.
You're essentially able to smoke the equivalent of a bag of weed in one hit.
Wow. Interesting.
And so I actually had a young man who came in my office and was acutely psychotic, and I ended up having to refer him to a psychiatric facility to get stabilized. And he had not done any other drugs than smoke marijuana.
Smoke marijuana. That's interesting. Well, and the other thing, too, is the whole thing with DAB or this wax form. It makes it easier, too, for kids to conceal it and smoke it, right? I mean, openly.
That's correct. So most of the kids that I have treated and that I know of are using e-hookahs or e-cigarettes.
Yes, yes, okay.
To smoke them, and it's virtually odorless. And so they're oftentimes smoking it during class, they're smoking it on break, they're smoking it in the morning, they're smoking it in the evening, and they're ingesting a lot more marijuana than if they were smoking the plant form that has a very distinct odor, and
right.
it's really obvious what's happening. And so a lot of kids are flying under the radar with this because, A, their parents don't know, or they don't know what to look for, or the school doesn't know or know what to look for, and it's so much easier to conceal.
Right. And so for that reason, then they're actually around school high all day and, you know, concealing the presence of getting in this whole form of getting high. And then the other part I look at that, too, is one of the things I've been reading or looking at some information and research, where now schools are starting to ban the e-cigarettes and things mm-hmm. of that nature as well for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But that's really interesting. Well, here's another question for you. Then what are the reasons why teens are using marijuana?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons why. I mean, you can look at the old sort of, oh, it's experimentation, which I think to an extent that's usually how it starts. It's peer pressure. It's peer culture. It could be influenced by, parental beliefs about the harmlessness of marijuana. But when you really look at substance dependency or addiction, you know, kids who are really unable to stop smoking because they've developed a physiological dependence or a psychological dependence on the substance, what we're seeing is that kids are using because they're stressed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've lectured in high schools all over the San Francisco Bay Area, and when I ask for a show of hands how many of these kids are stressed, 100% of them are raising their hands. Because it's stressful to be a teenager these days with academic pressure and social pressure and, just the immediacy of information on the internet and
yes.
social media and everything. There's a lot of pressure to be a kid these days. And so marijuana has come to be seen as a great stress reliever because it works.
Reliever.
That's the tricky thing about drugs is that they work really effectively in the short term to mitigate symptoms, but they create so many more problems in the long term. And so we're seeing that kids are stressed, but then we're also seeing that kids are using marijuana to manage anxiety, social anxiety, or other kinds of academic anxieties. And I've actually seen an interesting correlation in the onset of use, kids starting to smoke weed around 9th or 10th grade with a correlation with learning disabilities. And so maybe an undiagnosed learning disability that was the kid was able to kind of compensate for that during elementary and middle school. But once they hit high school, when the expectations academically increase and their learning disabilities declare themselves, we often see that kids start self-medicating insecurities. They start self-medicating, academic struggles with marijuana.
Wow, it's interesting. Interesting.
But I think also, one of the big things that I've seen is, when kids are really using a lot, it's because they're suffering. And their suffering isn't always really obvious, and it's not always what one would think would cause suffering. But they're struggling with differentiation from their parents. They're struggling with divorce or adoption issues or attachment issues.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot that happens in the adolescent psyche that I think we forget about as we get older. We forget what it was like to be a teenager
kid, yes.
and how hard it was. And so that's what I'm seeing is that it's sometimes it's just a lot of overwhelming kind of interpersonal and intrapsychic stuff that they're struggling with.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, Jennifer, because you said as a kid, the things that we would struggle over and we forget. I mean, that was never a problem for me because I was never a kid. We do forget, right? What it's like to be a kid. And I'm around teens and kids quite a bit because of a lot of work that we do. And it's just interesting. I mean, it is different from when I was growing up and years ago when it was just that whole thing, go out and be a kid. And you're right, the pressures, the social media. I mean, just from the social media, some of the things that I've seen, and to me, that's almost a world within itself where I'm watching kids inadvertently perpetrate to be something that they're really not,
mm-hmm.
And then to live up to that. And it's just, it is tough to be a teen in these days,
mm-hmm.
So I guess as adults, and it's our job to help navigate and help them, to navigate the future forward. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. And I think that in order for us to best help them navigate, it's not to get in and do for them.
Yeah,
so
like
know,
that.
Because so much of what we see in terms of parenting styles is either parents who are just too busy to be involved, or maybe parents who are overly involved. And so it's sort of our job as parents, and I'm a parent myself, you know, outside of the work I do healing families, I'm a parent myself. And so to really look at how can I best help my child to learn how to live in the world without me getting in and doing it for them. And so I think that involves having good communication with our kids, to be able to read them better, and to slow ourselves down as parents and as educators and as, you know, trusted advisors and mentors of teenagers, is to slow ourselves down to really be able to tune in to their behavior, to their language, to all of those subtleties that we sometimes miss because we're so busy going and doing in our adult lives.
Right. That is so true. As a parent myself and a grandparent, and then I look at my background with a, you know, behavioral science background, like I tell my kids, it's just I'm trained to, I watch patterns. I'm listening, but I said, I hear what you're saying, but I'm watching patterns. I said, if I see something long enough, it's telling me something, you know, and a lot of times I will talk to them. I said, let's address these issues. And they're like, what do you mean, Dad? I mean, you know, and I would say X, Y, Z. I said, well, why do you say that? I said, because this is what I see. And I guess going back to what you're saying, Jennifer, if we don't slow down and we pay attention, we'll miss it. And then what happens, some things I realize, even looking at some of the crisis intervention work, we'll find ourselves dealing with these crises that could have been dealt with much sooner before mm-hmm. it even got to that point. And mm-hmm. because we're busy.
Yeah. Well, and that's the tricky piece about marijuana and adolescence, because I've worked with a number of families who the parents knew that their kids were smoking weed and essentially either adopted a don't ask, don't tell policy within their household, or explicitly said, you know, I know what you're doing and that's fine, just don't do it in the house.
Right, right.
And then they were, you know, shocked and appalled and overwhelmed when their son, you know, ended up using to the point that he needed to get residential treatment. You know, these things don't happen overnight. They evolve over time. And so the challenging piece as a parent is to really kind of know where you stand on it, because you can't have it both ways. You can't sort of say, okay, it's okay you're doing this, just don't do it in the house, because then you're complicit to it. And then you can't then, you know, ride your white horse in later and say, oh, this is horrible, you're smoking too much. It was okay when you were only smoking a little, but now it's too much, because it sends a mixed message.
Well, I think the other part of that, too, with the potency, like you're saying, is much higher. You know, you don't have to smoke as much to get a more concentrated effect of the drug or the marijuana, versus parents going, well, I'd rather for them to be smoking marijuana than to be doing heroin.
Exactly.
You know, and which I see a lot of that as well.
Right. Well, because most parents have a point of reference from when they were growing up or when they were teenagers, when the potency of marijuana was significantly lower and its accessibility was less. It was a lot harder to get weed 20 years ago than it is now.
Yes.
And so, you know, I think that a lot of parents have it in their minds that, well, I did it and I was okay, or it wasn't that big of a deal, because they're coming from an antiquated standpoint and they haven't really understood the way it's evolved and how easy it is to get and how strong it is now, and also, you know, with the dabs and the wax, you know, really how dangerous it is.
Right, right. It's interesting. And, you know, when you think you know something, like myself, and you're around this, and then just hearing what you're sharing, it just makes it that much more insightful. That's why I love that we have professionals that are in the field who are actively doing this kind of work to be able to come on the show and share this kind of information, because it's so insightful and so helpful. So I want to say thank you for being part of the show. Another question I have is this, Jennifer. When I look at, you know, from the standpoint of socioeconomics, would you say maybe, is there a difference from looking at an underserved community versus more of an affluent community, who is smoking and who's not? Or is it just kind of, would you say, general across the board?
I'm seeing it generally across the board, frankly. I don't think that it's targeting one socioeconomic status group or another.
Okay.
Because I've treated kids from across the spectrum who are, you know, struggling with it. I think it's out there. It's easy to get, and you know, you've got, you know, kids from East Oakland and kids from Marin County are all smoking weed, and they're smoking a lot of it.
Right. So it's just part of the culture, what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, and I think that, you know, because it is so prevalent in the media and because it's so prevalent in entertainment, and
right.
It really has been decriminalized. Because if you think about, you know, 40, 50 years ago, people were getting thrown in jail for smoking weed. It was the whole reefer madness. It was horrible. It was, you know, there was a lot of stigma around it. And
right.
Now... it's pretty much part of the social lexicon. It's really been decriminalized to the point that it's legal in several states.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, think about just 10 years ago. Can you imagine that people would be able to go to Colorado and buy weed legally? It's just, it was unimaginable then. That was
right.
Just something that you did in Holland. And you had to go across the country, you know, across the world halfway to do it. So
right.
I think that it's been decriminalized and demystified to the point that it's not considered that big of a deal anymore.
Well, you know, I think of too, when I look at of terms of history, historically, and I look at, you know, at one point, the whole thing about prohibition, where, you know, it was, you know, to drink alcohol. I mean, it was like, wow, that was like bad stuff. It was
mm-hmm.
illegal. And, you know, and eventually it became part of the social norm. It became legalized. It became okay. But we see the effects of alcohol today is destroying families and lives, because at the core of it, it's not good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it became a social norm. The same thing, I look at this trend with marijuana. It seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, it's going in that same direction.
Well, and I think that it's, you know, again, and this is such a hot debate, you know, when you get into looking at legalization and taxation
yes.
and revenue
yes.
and harm and the perception of harm. When, you know, not everyone who smokes marijuana is going to become an addict, right? It's really not about that. It's really more about looking at the age of onset for
right.
kids who are smoking it. And if an 11-year-old was drinking a fifth of vodka, people would be up in arms about it.
Right.
But an 11-year-old who's smoking weed, and I've treated kids who started smoking at 11, it's, you know, oh, well, you know, it's a rite of passage. It's not that bad. It's what they
right.
do. It's okay. You know, it's from the earth. It's herbal or whatever. And you know, there's all this rhetoric around it. But really, let's look at it. Is it really okay for an 11, 12, or 13-year-old kid to be getting stoned all day?
Well, my personal opinion, I would say no. That's me. That's Marvin speaking. Because when I think about, when I understand or have some type of insight to this whole neuroscience and the brain development, and we look at, you know, the brain, especially if you start looking at a male, doesn't start to really fully develop to like age 25. So if we're altering, you know, any forms of that at the early, you know, onset of adolescence, then what are we altering?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're basically talking about, we're causing damage, or there can be damage to this brain that, I'm not saying it can't be fixed, but it just becomes other social and other personal issues around it that have to be dealt with, that, you know, eventually there's treatment needed or there's some type of intervention, you know, whether it's academically, socially, or whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and I think if you just look at the science, it's hard to argue with the science. And now, just within the last 10 years, there's been some really
yes.
great brain research that's come out about the effects of cannabis specifically on the adolescent brain. And so if you look at the fact that we as a species have what's called an endogenous cannabinoid system, right? Just like we have an endogenous meaning built in, right?
Right, this uh-huh.
part of our wiring and our neurotransmitters in our brain.
Right.
Just like we're built in with an endogenous opioid system, right? We have,
yes.
you know, epinephrine and norepinephrine and things in our brain that help with pain relief, right?
Yep, naturally.
We have what they have now found is a built-in endogenous cannabinoid system. So there's cannabinoid receptors in our brain. And it's a very delicate system that manages mood and affect and, you know, coordination and all of these things. It's a very delicate system that's easily disrupted when you flood it with outside cannabis. When you bring that cannabis into the system, it floods it and it dysregulates it. And because it's such a fragile neurotransmitter system, it's really difficult to get it re-regulated.
Re-regulated, yes. So what happens, it becomes unbalanced.
Exactly. And so, you know, again, it's hard to, it's sort of that chicken or the egg thing. You know, you have someone with really horrible anxiety. Did they have that anxiety before they started smoking, or is that anxiety a result of the imbalance within their brain?
Their brain, right, right. This is interesting, all very interesting stuff. And now, going back to earlier, as you were, we were talking about marijuana being a gateway, was thought to be a gateway to other drugs. And as you're saying that, because of the potency and where marijuana or weed is at today, it is not necessarily that gateway, because kids can stop or not continue forward because of the potency of where marijuana or weed is at today. Can you speak a little more about gateway?
Certainly. Well, I mean, I've treated about, you know, about 85% of the boys that come through Muir Wood are cannabis dependent. So we really see a lot of that in our facility. Mm. And many of those kids have never used anything other than cannabis.
Okay.
And yet their lives have become so unmanageable because of cannabis that they needed to be put in residential treatment. And the thing that I find most fascinating, because I have a background in treating opiate withdrawal, and I'm actually seeing kids who are coming into treatment who are detoxing off of daily marijuana smoking, and they're having very significant withdrawal symptoms like agitation, flu-like symptoms, they're sweaty, they're achy, they're highly anxious. And they look like people that are kicking opiates, frankly.
Wow.
And most people, and I've actually had this conversation with kids who are in detox, and they're looking at me saying, what's the matter with me? And I said, welcome to detox, my friend. This is your body trying to get off of the substance that you've been putting into it every day for a year.
Gee, that's interesting.
And so when we talk about things like gateway drugs, you know, we just by saying it's a gateway, it tends to minimize it, right?
Makes right.
It seem like it's less harmful.
It's less harmful, yes.
And that's why I think that we need to look at marijuana as being just as dangerous. It's not as lethal, perhaps, as opiates or you know, benzodiazepines, for example.
Okay.
But it is just as dangerous because, again, if the body goes into that kind of withdrawals when it doesn't have that substance anymore, that tells you that it's pretty significant.
Right. That is true. That is true. Well, my question now, at the treatment at your facilities, for would it outpatient or would it be residential?
Well, we actually do both. We have a residential program that's located in Petaluma, California, which is north of San Francisco.
Okay.
And it is a 6-bed residential program for boys only. So we treat boys ages 12 to 17. And then we also have an intensive outpatient program, which is evenings, and that's located in Mill Valley, California, which, again, is just across the Golden Gate Bridge.
Okay.
And that is a mixed gender program, so it treats boys and girls ages 12 to 18.
Okay. Now, typically, how do you treat, I mean, when you start talking about the dependency on cannabis, maybe that's like something you would like to share. How do you treat it? I mean, what's the, you know, whether it's inpatient or outpatient, what's the best way? I mean, you being an expert at this, how do you guys deal with these issues?
That's a great question. I think that, you know, if I were to boil it down into its barest essentials, the best treatment of cannabis dependence is to really understand what the underlying issues are.
Okay, that's good.
Because if we look at addiction, or even if it's just abuse, right? Not every kid that comes to treatment is an addict, quote unquote.
Okay.
But they have all been abusing a substance to the point where it's being used in a way that's detrimental to them. And so if we look at that use as a symptom of a larger problem, we can chase the symptom all day long, but until we actually address what the problem is, the symptom won't go away completely. And so that's why when, you know, parents put their kids on lockdown, or, you know, they change schools, or they make them change friends, That's all a way of treating the symptom. But really, until we understand what the underlying problem is, it's never going to get resolved. And so really, that's where our focus is that we have a really clinically intensive program that looks at things like self-esteem, okay, anxiety, depression, learning disabilities, underlying identity issues, attachment, adoption, divorce, family systems issues, because, you know, a lot of distress that I've seen in the kids that I've treated centers in the family.
Right.
And so we spend a lot of time doing a lot of family work, both educating parents as well as doing intensive family therapy to get at those root issues.
Root issues, yes.
Because, you know, ultimately, like I said, you can chase the symptom all day long, but
right,
why would you do that? Why would you not want to solve the problem? And it's hard to solve the problem, and it requires a lot of effort on the part of the entire family. It's not just, you know, send Johnny to rehab and hope that all is well. It's everybody has to have skin in that game.
Right.
Because kids are not living in a vacuum, and so you can't treat them in a vacuum.
It's kind of it's ironic that you say that, and I'm chuckling here because he says, well, why would we not want to get to the issue, the core issues, right? And
mm-hmm.
and there are some organizations out there, I said, all for the wrong reasons, you know, because I want them to keep coming back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unfortunately, there are programs out there that do that. I mean, it's about keeping beds full, and it's a business. So, but at the core of it, when I look at a true professional, it is about looking at being systematic and really getting to the core of the issues so a person can become whole. And
exactly.
I use the metaphor, I've used it once before on the show, it's like an iceberg. You know, what we see of an iceberg is only 10% of the full iceberg, and it's what we see what's above the surface, and that's like addiction, or that's like these, as we're looking at the symptoms, we see these things. But when we want to look at the drivers, which 90% of the issues are below the surface. And that's the thing, and that's what I see with what you're sharing as far as treatment. You know, when we start looking at some of the family system and those dynamics, that's the part that we don't readily see, and we have to go beneath the surface to get to those issues so that we can cure or take care of that 10% of what's magnified as the bigger issue.
Exactly. I love that metaphor myself, and I use it when I'm talking with both kids and parents. And I remind people that the part of the iceberg that sunk the Titanic was not the part that they could see.
Yes, I like that. That is true. That is true. Well, why should parents consider residential treatment for marijuana use or dependency? And hold that thought, Jennifer. We're going to take a commercial break real quick, and when we come back, I want to lead into that question.
Okay.
All right?
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
Once again, this is Answers for the Family, and I'm your host, Marvin Smith. And our guest today is Jennifer Golick, and she is a clinical director of Muir Woods Teen Treatment Center in Northern California, specifically, Jennifer?
In Petaluma.
Petaluma. So, anyway, I as I close before the commercial, Jennifer, I asked the question, why should parents consider residential treatment for marijuana use or dependency?
Well, I think that residential treatment is often viewed as being punitive and maybe heavy-handed. And I think that parents need to look at residential treatment as being like an immersion program into health, and really look at it as the best quality and possible treatment to avoid their child continuing to suffer. Now, that being said, not every kid is going to need that level of care right away. And so I really encourage parents to take a thorough evaluation of what's happening in their child's life. You know, how are they doing in school? What are their friends like? How are they doing at home? Are they being oppositional? Are they sneaking out? Are they having legal consequences? And when you start seeing the things adding up in terms of, you know, there are some things that are happening around their substance use, I think you have to really seriously consider doing residential treatment, because the fact of the matter is you can sign up for an hour of therapy every week. And I know that it's really easy to keep the mask on during that hour of therapy. It's 1 hour a week, right? There's lots of places for me to hide around that. But residential treatment is 24/7 observation, evaluation, and intervention. And that's the luxury that we have at the residential level of care, is that we're able to see teens come in with their mask on, and they can't hold it up 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so they have to drop the mask, and they have to get real. And we're there when that happens. And so we're able to really meet them where they're at and explore their ideas, to understand their way of thinking. And so really, again, like I said, it functions like an immersion program. So they are living in a healthy environment, they're getting healthy food, they're being exposed to healthy coping mechanisms to deal with their stress, to deal with their anxiety. They're being evaluated by very sophisticated clinicians who can, you know, maybe see if they need medication for ADHD, or if there's some underlying issue that has not been diagnosed yet. You know, there's lots of opportunities for very, very thorough evaluation that would be almost impossible to put together on an outpatient basis. I mean, you'd have to be driving hither and yon to appointments all the time to be able to get this kind of information, and there's no guarantee that your child's going to be sober while they're doing that. And so it seems like it's a moot point to do all of these evaluations when your kid is still smoking, because you're not going to be able to get a sense of what they're really presenting with.
Right. Like you said,
and so residential treatment, you know, residential treatment also is for the whole family, because so many parents feel powerless. They feel like they have no options. They feel like they have no resources. And, you know, there's 80,000 books on the market to teach you how to be a better parent. But when your family's in crisis, who has time to read?
Right.
And so residential treatment treats the whole family, and it is an intensive educational program for parents. It's therapeutic for parents, and it offers parents opportunities in real time to learn how to do things differently, and to learn to teach people, parents and children, how to talk to one another in a more meaningful way. And yes. So I really view residential treatment as being an opportunity for growth and health, versus a punitive measure to be, you know, put out when someone gets in trouble or gets caught doing something wrong.
Right, right. I like that statement. I like how you poise that. And 'cause one thing I look at, too, is which is really good. Earlier you stated about once you're in treatment, you have a chance for observation, evaluation, and then treatment. You know, and I think when you're under that constant monitoring, I always look at you're trying to find the best solution, and when you're constantly evaluating the situation and you have that person around, there's a lot more information to work with in that process. And like you said, it's very holistic. You know, it's the diet, it's the interaction, it's the social dynamics. All these things are happening, and to me, there's a greater probability of success in treating that individual than the outpatient, if it's more, especially if they're more severe.
Exactly. Well, and I think because our program is very comprehensive and we have different modalities of interventions,
yes,
we're able to reach kids who maybe don't want to sit and talk, but they'll go to equine therapy, for example, and they'll have an experience at equine therapy that's very instructive for the clinical staff, and that's totally nonverbal.
Right.
Or, for example, they will be going to, we have our residents go to a private gym where they learn CrossFit and mixed martial arts, and maybe something will come up in that domain that we didn't expect, and we fold that into our understanding and our knowledge about this person. Or something may come up during a family session that gives us insight into why this kid acts the way he does with certain staff. So again, it's ongoing information that's pouring in, because it's all of these different modalities. It's not just sit down in group therapy or sit down in individual therapy and just tell me everything that's wrong with you, because, you know, how many teenagers want to do that, right? No. We have to get creative, and we have to mine for data in ways that they don't really know we're mining for data. So it's kind of like the Jedi mind trick, right?
We're
always learning things about them, and they don't even think that we're paying attention. It's a great way for us to really have a better understanding of what's going on with that teen so that we can treat it effectively.
When I look at two, is you
because
look
I don't at, believe that rubber stamp treatment is the way
it works. Yes,
that you're effectively going to treat them.
Like for me, it's like education. You know, one shoe doesn't fit all, because all kids are different, and we really look at need to how to tailor how we even educate kids. And I think I really believe like what you're sharing is great, because when you look at the modalities and you look at that the more interaction, the more opportunities of seeing and understanding to be able to make corrective change for all the right reasons. And it takes time, and that's what I like about when you start to look at the different modalities and being in treatment or residential treatment. So you guys are doing, sound like you guys are doing some great work. I think I might come and admit myself just to hang out.
Well, I have had quite a few parents say that when they come to our facility, because we're located on 6 acres in rural Petaluma, and it's, you know, we have a pond on the property where the residents can go fishing, and you know, we're surrounded by farms and horses and pigs, and it's, you know, a beautiful turn of the century farmhouse that's a very homey environment. And you know, the residents get yoga and meditation every week, and they get to go on these wonderful all-day adventure outings on Sundays where they go out into the wilderness and go hiking or kayaking or stand-up paddleboarding. And I have a lot of parents that ask if they can check themselves in as well, because, you know, how many times do we get that kind of opportunity to do that kind of intensive self-reflection and growth in our lives? It's rare.
It's rare. I know next time I'm in Northern California, Petaluma, I'm going to have to detour and make it a point to come in and visit and say hello.
That would be fantastic.
Just after about a week, you're going to say, we've got to get rid of this guy. What's going on here?
He came for lunch and he never left.
He never left. I was like, I need all the help I can get. Now, on that note, I mean, it's really great. I mean, so you're talking about parents, involvement, the whole family. You know, it's a family affair. I like that. Now, then this kind of leads into the question, why do parents need to be involved in the treatment?
Oh, boy. Why shouldn't parents be involved in the treatment? I mean...
Yeah, I hear you. And I'm just, you know, I've seen both sides of the equation. I've seen it that parents who are very interactive and they want to be a part of the, you know, involved in the process and understanding. And there are those that, hey, you fix it. Let me know when it's done. And the person, they're better for society or better to come home. Let me know and we'll bring them home.
Right. Well, it's scary to go through this process. It's not only scary for the adolescent to really look at these bigger issues, you know, at 15, 16, 17 years old, but it's hard for their parents, too, because, you know, all parents came from parents, and people have stuff from their own childhood that comes in and affects how they're parenting their child. And to go under the microscope, for example, is terrifying. But what I've seen is that if people can push past that fear of what they might find or fear of being exposed and really look at it as an opportunity to make change, that the whole family can grow and that there can be such an enriched relationship in adolescence that it doesn't have to be this horribly conflict-filled experience for parents and children. It doesn't have to be that way. But it's just about everybody kind of learning new skills and learning how to apply the skills that they know in a different and more meaningful way. And so what parent wouldn't want to get along with their teenager better? You know, what parent wouldn't want their teenager to feel like they can trust them enough to come talk to them if they have a problem?
Well, any parent in their right mind.
But it's scary. You know, it's scary to get in our right minds because, yes. you know, a lot of us don't want to look at what we know is there.
Yes.
And so it's a very personal decision on every parent's part about making the decision to put their child in treatment. But any treatment that's worth its salt is going to require parents to be involved because, like I said earlier, kids are not raised in a vacuum. And so if you treat these kids in a vacuum and you return them home and nothing has changed at home, the expectation that they're going to be able to sustain that change is unrealistic.
It's unrealistic. It's unrealistic. It just doesn't happen. Just doesn't happen. That's really good. So, yeah, parents, I think that that is right. Parents need to be involved in maybe in half a minute because I can't believe that we're down to the last 4 or 5 minutes of the show. Wow, it's going by fast. That's what happens when you're having a good time. A lot of great information.
I know.
You know, geez. And I have a question from a call-in listener that I definitely want to get to. But in the process of the parent, so at your facility or through your organization, do you guys make efforts or amends to actually reach out to the parent and educate them in the process of involvement?
We do. We involve the parents from the beginning.
Okay.
We have a comprehensive parent education program that happens every Saturday. And so we bring in our family group on Saturdays. We bring in experts on addiction and adolescent brain development from all over the Bay Area who will come in and lecture to the families on various topics, neurobiology of addiction, codependency, family dynamics. And so they will educate the parents in the morning. And then in the afternoon, we have what's called a multifamily process group. Where all of the parents and the residents get together, and we have a topic-driven discussion group about things that are relevant to, you know, life with an adolescent in your home or things that are germane to what they're learning in treatment. And so we really do involve the parents pretty conclusively, as well as we do individual family therapy every week. So each family that comes through our program gets between 8 and 10 hours of clinical exposure every week.
Every week. Well, that's good. That's really good.
And then for those families that are from out of the area or who aren't able to participate in person, we do use Skype technology to be able to have video conferencing.
Okay. Utilizing technology. That's good.
Geography should not be an impediment to treatment, in my mind.
Yes, especially with all the technology that we have today that to make, you know, space and proximity, you know, what do you call it, relative.
Exactly.
Here's a question, and we're down to the last 3 minutes. It says, my two brothers are on medical marijuana for one condition or another. They don't seem to be given any conscious thought to smoking in front of their kids. I am certain two of the teens are using, and my brothers and their wives are in denial because of their own habits. I don't want to see these great teens damage their future this way. Do you have any advice for me that I would not start a war with my family?
That's a really challenging situation because, you know, kids learn from their parents, right?
You just talked about parents. You just talked about parents.
Yeah. And so, you know, what I would encourage your caller to do is to go to those teens directly and try and engage a dialogue about what does marijuana do for them? You know, how is it helping them? And not to get into the rhetoric of why it's good, but just to understand what it's doing for them. Because really, anytime we use something to excess, it's because we're trying to meet a need.
Right.
Whether it's a need to fit in, a need to feel differently, a need to cope, whatever it is. And, you know, to approach them and to understand better what it does for them and why they do it, and just to explore them, you know, with them in a dialogue about, you know, hey, you know, have you ever thought about, you know, not smoking it or, you know, but just to be curious. And this is the thing that I find to be most effective when talking with teens about what they're doing, is to not tell them what not to do, but be curious about what they are doing. And not as a way to be complicit to it, but just take that sort of neutral, I'm really curious to understand, please tell me more about that. And what that does is it gets them thinking about it in a different way, because if you approach them, you know, with this full frontal assault of,
yes,
you know, weed is bad and you shouldn't smoke it, they've got arguments already prepared. They see you coming,
yes,
from a mile away.
Yes.
But while they're busy guarding their front door, they've left the back door wide open, and you can come in that way
come
and start
in, yes,
asking them these questions to get them to question their own thinking.
Yes. Well, Jennifer, thank you for your time. I can't believe we're out of time.
That went fast.
Oh, my gosh. Too fast. Once again, this is Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Marvin Smith. And our guest today was Jennifer Golick, licensed marriage family therapist, as a clinical director of Muirwood Teen Treatment Center. And Jennifer, is there any information you would like to give, a number, a website for listeners can follow up?
Certainly. You can visit our website. It has lots of information, as well as videos and pictures of the facility and information about substance abuse in teens. And that website is www.muirwoodteen.com. That's Muir, M as in Mary, U-I-R, Wood, Teen, T as in Tom, E-E-N as in Nancy.com.
Well, Jennifer, thank you very much. And this is the end of our show. Have a good
All right.
day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Chet W. Sisk. I'm an 11-year life coach and the leadership development specialist for a nonprofit called the World Assembly of Youth. I'm going to provide a year of online life coaching for everyone that signs up and becomes a sponsor for our new online leadership development app called the LEAD Course. The course was created for young leaders in emerging countries and new leaders here in the United States. It teaches a model of leadership that includes sustainability, loving kindness, vision, feminine principles, personal empowerment, and connectedness. The tuition for this class is only $50 a year, but in some parts of the world, that's more than a month's salary. We have students in Niger, Bangladesh, Malawi, Namibia, Mongolia, Brazil, and more countries that simply can't afford the $50 a year tuition to take the class. Now, to offset our cost, we need you to sponsor them. If you sign up and donate the $50 sponsor rate, one of the students from the countries mentioned will be able to take the class and further the world into a new direction in leadership. We can win the hearts and minds of young leaders now, while the window is open. Now, this isn't a something-for-nothing proposition. You sponsor them, and we'll provide you with an online life coaching package that will empower you on your path. Go to www.leadtheshift.com, click the Sign Up Now icon, register, then mark the Sponsor button. Be ready to receive your free online life coaching. Once you sign up, your life coaching starts immediately. We are in desperate need of at least 31 of you to sign up as soon as possible. Go to www.leadtheshift.com. Thank you.